Shrink Wrap Radio number 878. Steven Eisenstadt, PhD, discussing his new book, The Creative Matrix.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest is well-known Jungian author, educator, and dream worker, Dr. Steven Eisenstadt. We'll be discussing his 2023 book, The Imagination Matrix, How to Access the Greatest Power You Have for Creativity, Connection, and Purpose. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Steve Eisenstadt, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back. Good to be here.
Yeah, I say welcome back because it's been 10 years that we did an interview here on your book, Dream Tending.
Yes.
And now yet another book, and what a book it is, what a blockbuster book it is, and we're going to be talking about that in just a little bit. But one of the things I was wondering about is, I believe you were the founder of Pacifica Graduate School, is that right?
Yes, and you know what they say, once a founder, always a founder.
So, okay, yeah. Well, good. Yeah, I'm glad they're not taking that away from you. That, for anybody who is unaware, and I would think all of my listeners would be aware of it, but is the premier Jungian school to go to, if you know, in California, in the Santa Barbara area.
Yeah, we're located in Santa Barbara, two beautiful campuses here, and people internationally from all over come and gather, for a variety of programs.
Yeah, and of course, I've had lots of guests over the years who either got their degree from there or who are on the faculty there, and so that's wonderful. And now, in this new book, you make reference to a whole new direction that you've gone in, which I was surprised, delightfully shocked to see, United Nations and UNESCO. How did that happen?
Well, yes. So it began about, I would say 20 something years ago, even more now, a little bit. And I was teaching at Pacifica on the faculty. I was teaching a course in mythological studies and depth psychology. And one of the students actually worked for the Secretariat General of the UN. And they were gathering leaders, people, particularly heads of state from all over the world, two people from each country, to come together and to develop something called an Earth Charter. So it's called Earth Charter International, which is a set of soft guidelines that would then be translated into legal processes, procedures for countries worldwide looking forward to a sustainable planet. You know, there was the beginnings of awareness around the ecological crisis.
Uh-huh.
Now, what happened is I was there at the UN. I was really one of the youngest people there at that point in time, and not the most experienced, obviously, not politically, and I was not a head of state by any means, but they invited me because I was a proponent of a depth psychological point of view. an imagination-centered point of view. So the two people from the United States, Stephen Rockefeller and I, were invited. And I landed at The Hague, at The Hague, at the Peace Palace.
Wow.
Yeah, and there we met. And there were, Gorbachev at that point in time was the chair. Marie Strong from Canada was the person presiding. And we spent 4 nights, 5 days, just nonstop. And these are people, of course, the heads of state. They were very engaged, involved, for sure. And they brought top people, diplomats and or ambassadors, people that were really working ecologically with enormous skill sets. And we were going on and on for all those hours.
Wow.
Until, yeah, the story is at the very end. It was really quite something, actually, to this, just sharing the story now, I'm feeling my heart begin to
Yeah,
yeah. And I get up, and honestly, the level of dedication, sincerity, the intensity, really to make this work, it included First Nations people. It included people that were really, really invested in what it was that we were trying to do. And then Gorbachev, I'll never forget, stood up and said, look, as chairperson, I pronounce, unfortunately, after all the good work and all the drafts and mega drafts and all the preparation that we did before getting there, just to get anything into a document that is global, worldwide, is always a craft, to make sure that the language works and that it is available to everyone and not offensive to anybody. And he said, I announced, I have to say that I believe that we have failed in our pursuit. We have not been able to really bring to life what we wanted to. And of course, the gasp in the room was just extraordinary. And my heart just went. At that moment, I was standing at the podium next to speak just because it was nothing planned, And again, I was not the most experienced in the room. I went, whoa. And what happened at that moment was something else came through me. And it was part of what was going on with me in Australia when I had the very extraordinary privilege to be with and talk story with Aboriginal elders of the Dreamtime.
Wow.
And a big dream happened in Australia. I was asked to visit a place called Gowanna Dreaming, which is in Australia, is a actual rock in Arnhem Land, which is sacred territory for the Aboriginals. And I heard something that was like 8, 10 months before, and I didn't know what it meant at all. There in Australia, in that tradition, in many traditions, you don't really interpret dreams. There's not dream analysis. You actually visit the place of the dreaming and listen. And the place of the dreaming offers guidance and support. Well, I felt something move through me. I remember I was with my 14-year-old son, and he was, we were given permission. We're the only white people that were allowed back there, actually, because of this elder who gave us that permission. And then when I was standing at that podium, the words just came. They just flowed out of me.
Wow.
And I'm saying out of me, but certainly out of that dreaming impulse. And those words were, and I shared with the whole group, perhaps we're asking the wrong question. We're asking, what can we do to save the planet? And perhaps the question that we need to listen into is, what is the world? What is the planet asking of me, asking of us? What is the planet, the creatures, the landscapes, the buildings, the cities? What are they asking of us? Whoa, there was just absolute quiet in the room, for sure. I'll never forget. Gorbachev looked over, eyes open, said, yes. And Marie Strong said, let's do that. And I went back to Pacifica. We started an initiative. The World Council of Churches were there. There were a whole variety of other networks that were available. And what we did was to listen to the planet. And the way we listened in is we listened through dream. Because when dreams come, the images, the landscapes, the activities, the actions that are involved in the dream time, those emotions that come forward, right? They generate from not only us personally, personal psyche, or the collective side, the collective unconscious, also from the world soul, the world psyche. So when we listen to the language of the ocean in a dream, or a house in a dream, or a building in a dream, and listen to it speak on behalf of itself through the images in the dream, we hear something of what is being asked of us. And we did this for a year, year and a half, went back to the UN, reconvened. Long story went on, right? Then politics got involved. There was the United States vetoed it. China vetoed it.
Yeah.
Up and going, up and running. Yeah.
Wow. What an incredible story, and what an incredible opportunity to be there and, you know, with world leaders and taking part in something that could potentially save the planet. Talk about a humbling experience. That's got to take the cake.
Yeah, and that's right. Grounded in humility and service, for sure.
So I plan to ask you what was the inspiration for this book, but I think maybe you just told us. How long the book covers an awful lot of ground. How long did it take you to write it? I would think it would involve a lot of time and struggle and study.
Yes. Yeah, it did. I was inspired by the work I was doing in dream tending, you know, and the more I've been working with dreams now over four decades, you know, I work with people, I work with my own dreams in the morning, and something began to occur, and it just comes right out of that story, truth be told, right? And what happened is that dreams come forward, and I listen carefully. I associate to the dreams and understand what's going on in our life and how that's related to the dream and the guidance that's available, the warnings, the teachings, and so on. I listen to the mythic motifs that are available in dreams and the stories, the teaching stories that are part of a collective psyche, all extraordinarily useful personally, emotionally, psychologically, physiologically. And two, I notice that there's something more. In dreams, there is something of the pull of the future. You know, so the questions become, who's visiting now? What's happening here? What is the dream's desire? And that last question versus what does this mean? What does it have to do with me? You know, the person's approach, which is useful. It is. It's just in addition, there's something else. And when I listen that way and working with dreams and tending the work with dreams with folks, I notice that in each dream, there is a portal of some sort. There is an opening. There is a doorway, you know, and to listen with ears that can hear in that way, you know, we can experience the way the dream offers itself, not only to us personally, collectively, developmentally, all extraordinarily helpful, and to, you know, what opens in through that doorway, through that portal, and we open into a quality of imagination and what I call deep imagination, the autonomous imagination. It's a realm of experience, a field of experiencing, truly, that really offers something more.
Wow. And this book, there's no way that we could cover everything that's in this book, you know, in this conversation. So we'll just go where it wants to go. We'll try to be open to the pull of the future. And see where it's pulling us. Although I've kind of, you know, I'll bring up topics that are in the book. And I realize that I haven't really announced the title. I can't believe I didn't have it right here at top of my notes. But the title of the book is The Imagination Matrix, How to Access the Greatest Power You Have for Creativity, Connection, and Purpose. And that's a tall order right there.
It is a tall order. And as you shared, I spend about, you know, a lifetime in the making, actually where it originated probably most clearly is when a place when I was 12 years old, a place called Zuma Beach in California.
Yeah.
Outside of Los Angeles. Yeah.
And then, what happened when you were 12?
And
Zuma Beach.
Yeah. All right. It's another story.
Great.
Well, you know, I'm 12 and I lived in the San Fernando Valley, right? It's a suburb out of Los Angeles. And right over the mountains, just those foothills, the Pike Canyon Mountains, those mountains, there's a beach. And for all the people in suburbia, in the valley, that's the beach that we would go to. It's the closest one
Yeah.
that was accessible. And my parents would take us on the weekends. You know, that's part of what we did in the summer. Maybe even every other weekend. It was a very safe, family-oriented beach. Lifeguard stands one place to the next. Big places where it says food, you go get your food. Big
Yeah.
parking, you know, you got it. It's just a perfect family-oriented beach. And so
Yeah.
many people, I mean, just people everywhere. Friendly, safe, you know, supervised. And there was always this idea that there is a jetty on the left side, that Los Angeles south side, and it went out into the ocean from the sand. And the idea was you would never go on the other side of that jetty, not really, because that's not part of this beach. Well, you know, I'm 12, naturally curious, like many of us are. I mean, it wouldn't be probably in this conversation there wasn't a sense of curiosity that sparked our sensitivity and all else of what goes into being part of this world. So the tide went out. It was a minus tide, which meant the tide went really far out. And my parents would always tell us, hey, be careful. There are no lifeguard stands. You just stay here where you're supervised by
Right,
people. My curiosity got the best of me, of course, right?
yeah.
So the tide went way out. I walked around the jetty because there was sand to do that and went to the other side. And on the other side of that jetty was something extraordinary for me. First, there were no people, right? Very few people. And actually, the three or four people that I saw, I remember I'm 12, so I'm not really, but you know, even without bathing suits, if you know what I'm saying. So it's kind of like a little bit of a nude beach, but more importantly, I wasn't captivated at all by that at that age. What I was captivated by was that the tide went out and those tide pools were incredible, you know, and the rock that came out of the sea and the little entities, the little fish and the kelp and oh my goodness, everything was moving around. It was just illuminated, truly. And I was just sitting and noticing and watching. And I heard a voice. I did. It was right behind me.
Wow.
And the voice said, "Did you know that rocks can talk?" Whoa. Whoa. I mean, I knew that, but I never shared that with anybody, and nobody ever shared it with me, right? Did you know that rocks could talk? I looked around, and it was a person. He was maybe a 17-year-old, I think, 17, 16, 17, 18-year-old surfer. He had just had a surfboard. He was walking by, noticed me there, and simply shared that. I was taken. Rocks could talk, which started the whole work of listening to soul, psyche in the world, as if the voices of things are in the actuality of the places, landscapes, creatures of the world, an animated world, you know, an experience that many traditions and certainly many peoples throughout human experience have had. We've lost that pretty much in modern society, but an
Right.
animated world, right? Well, that touched me deeply. But then,
Yeah.
you know, hours went by. I looked up and oh my goodness, right?
I was
The
wondering if that was going to
That's
happen.
what happened. The tide came way in, and I went, oh. So I just took off and really literally kind of went fast, ran a little bit to get just around in time the other side. And of course,
Yeah.
everything's the same over there. It's the civilized side of the beach, right? The lifeguard stands are there, the food stands are there, everybody's there with their families. And my mom sees me. She says, "Hey, Steve, where have you been?" What am I going to say? Where have you been? I've been on the other side of the beach where rocks can talk. And then I just said, "I was just walking about and I'm back here now. Everything is good. I'm safe." She goes, "Oh, great. Hey, you know, you've been gone a little longer than I'd like. So be conscious of that." But that moment changed my life. And honestly, you mentioned Pacifica Graduate Institute. As I got into the field of depth psychology, you know, and started to study people, and I was working with Joseph Campbell at the time, and we got very close, and he would visit constantly to Pacifica. And then the work of Marion Widman and then James Hillman, his work came forward. And the whole idea of the world alive, psyche, soul in and of the world, which became Pacifica's mission statement, motto, its mission statement, Anima Mundi Calendi Gratia, for the sake of tending psyche, soul, in and of the world, the peoples, the places, the animals, the landscapes. So, yeah, that I think that just now that we're talking, that story, yeah, which I haven't thought about.
And so Pacifica, so it's kind of on the Pacific, and I'm wondering if somehow, how did that name get adopted?
Stories. I love these stories. I haven't shared.
Great.
Because we tried everything, honestly, when we became this institution. I have not shared the story in decades and decades and decades. We tried a lot of things. We didn't know what our name would be. I mean, we evolved. We found a location. We started a campus, you know, and we evolved from a community counseling center in a little place in Isla Vista, which is right next to the University of California, Santa Barbara, a student community. But then we became a school, a university, right? And all that went into evolving that. And so what will our name be? I tried a lot. I tried, well, first we tried just talking with, you know, our elders. So I asked Ross Widman, Marion Widman. I asked Joseph Campbell. And we came up and we tried Blake Institute. I'll never forget. I called Ross Widman, who's a Blake scholar, one of the top scholars internationally. Hey, Ross, we're thinking of naming the institution Blake University. What do you think? Blake Institute. He laughed and then he said, seriously, Stephen, the one thing you never want to do is name this Blake University. And you know how much I cherish, honor, respect, and teach the work, his work. But it's too complicated. He's too complicated. The whole thing is too complicated. This what, you know, this wisdom coming in from these elders. So it was one thing after that. Then we thought, well, okay, maybe that's not the right approach. Let's try something else. So then we thought, what names would people really identify with, right? Then we thought, well, how about Evergreen University? Just came up with the name. That kind of didn't go over so well because a big housing development just opened 6 miles, 10 miles up the coast, Evergreen. You know? So that didn't quite work. Then we thought, well, we'll go to advertisement, an agency. Agencies know how to do this, right? We'll do
yeah, that. Right.
Commercially, we'll do that. That didn't work. We had like a name every 2 months, and I'll never forget, we were at the new campus for the first years, and that first group of students, they got t-shirts, and they put the six names that we tried out, they put them on the shirt, crossed out, crossed out, crossed out.
So funny.
They were laughing. They were like, hey, you just changed the name again? You know, again? So what happened finally is, to answer your question very directly, I was up in Port Townsend, Washington State, and I was with my mentor, a Jungian analyst, an extraordinarily gifted human being, Russell Lockhart. And I slept one night, and in a dream, the dream did open to the imagination. And out of this deep well of imagination came the word Pacifica. Ah, Pacifica. So it came not from my mind, not from the rational mind, from the dream time.
Not from the advertising agency.
No, it just did not and didn't come anywhere. And then it just, I thought, well, Pacifica, it found us. We're on the Pacific Ocean anyway, so there's some relevance, right? Pacifica has that quality, you know, of the generativity in her. And so that's what came forward. And honestly, once that name came forward, it was just immediately embraced. It had a life of its own, truly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a great story and another great experience. And what a privilege you had to be able to become friends with these seminal figures in the Jungian movement. You know, that's just precious there. I you know, by the way, I grew up in Los Angeles, and the beach, I didn't go to that beach. I went to other beaches like Venice and Santa Monica beaches. And that was a probably had a big impact on my psyche as well. And I've never thought about it before in terms of, say, my career. But I do recall that when I went away to college, which turned out to be the University of Pennsylvania initially, and then the University of Michigan and so on, and University of Montana. But there was this longing for the beach. That's what I missed. And there were experiences that I had at the beach where, again, the tide situation, there was a beach, which I recall, and I was, you know, being a kid, I had not reached my full height yet. And I'm hearing another voice cut in. Did you hear that?
No.
It's a little bit of an echo. I hope that doesn't continue to be a problem. It only happens when I talk. Maybe I'm not supposed to talk, but I want to finish this story. So being not having my full height, I would go out as far as I could by kind of bouncing. There'd be sort of like hills in the sand, and I would bounce between those hills. And but again, there was that danger of getting caught too far out. But it did have a profound impact on my psyche. And of course, I probably had lots of dreams about the ocean. I'll have to look back in my dream journals. So this is wonderful. So I'm still getting that echo a little bit. Too bad. We'll continue on. That is very distracting. You know how if you get feedback on your voice, it jams you up so that you can't talk?
Totally. Yeah, it's very challenging. It is.
Yeah, so maybe I'm not supposed to talk. So I sort of marked, you know, a bunch of the things in the book. You talk about the source code of imagination. Tell us about that.
Yes. And for me, we're born with that blueprint. We're born with the blueprint of our becoming. I believe that. I believe each of us arrives with that inheritance. And I think human experience arrives with a particular code, so to speak, that originates not only in our family of origin. It's not our life script, not other people's expectations. There's a certain kind of authenticity, an innate calling or genius that is available. And that unfolds when we access these realms of deep imagination. And I go through it in the imagination matrix in the book. You know, I just take the time to really slow that down and go through it in detail, elaboration and story, example, and also offer a whole variety of ways of gaining access. And one way is just what you were describing, you know, when you were talking about being at the beach and as a kid bouncing up around the sun. I mean, what was happening is you're in child play. We all have some recollection of that for the most part.
Yeah.
We're in the child's mind. We're not childish, but we are in the spontaneity of that kind of imaginal play. And we're following something. We're following curiosity. We get curious and we allow curiosity to come forward. And oh my goodness, you know, the research that's come forward in relation to curiosity, when we can tap into curiosity, something different happens, right? We begin to shift our experience. We go into a theta mind rather than in an alpha-centered mind, which means that we have a different quality of experience, which can be measured. And I spent years, as you mentioned, in research, qualitative and quantitative. When we are in that place, something opens that's different than what we're ordinarily experiencing. It's not programmed. And we're all subject now to so many codes, programmers' codes, you know, that we're just bombarded with the media of every kind. You know, screen time is ubiquitous. It's everywhere.
Right.
All fantastic. It's wonderful. And two, when it's too much, then of course there's trouble. And I'll share this. I just got back just a week or two ago from China, and I'll share that story, which has a lot to do with what we're talking about now. Before I do, though, curiosity. Curiosity, you know, clinically, therapeutically, when I'm working with people or when I'm supporting folks in their own training to become therapists, clinicians, I really, really put value in opening the curious mind, because you really can't be curious. When I'm curious, I mean authentically curious, I'm not anxious. And when I'm authentically curious, I'm not depressed. You can't be really curious in that way and depressed and/or anxious at the same time. They're reciprocal inhibitors. So opening curiosity just in and of itself has its own value. And in turn, right? It opens our system physiologically, yeah, and emotionally to a different rhythm, to a different cadence. And we become much more resonant to what we've been talking about, to what is the rhythm of nature, right? The rhythm, deeper rhythm that fills us. And there is so much research now that links that quality of curiosity to creativity, innovation, ingenuity. I mean, it's no wonder that institutions from Harvard Business School to so many creativity incubators that are now embedded in bigger institutions and corporations have really discovered that opening creativity, opening what we're talking about, that quality of being curious, the curious mind, not the rational or the analytic mind only. Obviously, there's a place for that. It's incredibly important. It's how we conduct business and maneuver and, you know, get around in the world. It's important. And too, though, not at the full expense of our creative life. And that's where the imagination matrix takes us, into our creativity, into that curiosity. And I'll tell you, just as I said, I got back from China, and oh my goodness. Okay, China is very similar. And of course, when I say I got back from China, China first is a big place. I mean, New York City is something of a suburb. You know, in Los Angeles, the big metropolitan areas in the United States.
Right.
And that's compared to all kinds of Beijing or all kinds of Shanghai, that it's, you know, it's big in proportion. But one of the things that's going on in China and other places as well is that young people, when they get into their late teens, early 20s, and they've grown up now with so much technology, they're on screen a lot, you know, that they have drifted away from being in relationship with the body. And that's happening in the United States as well, as we know, right? The too muchness of screen time creates all kinds of psychological afflictions, everything from cyberbullying, right, to cyber addiction, and the list goes on and on. So there's all kinds of ways of trying to come at that. That's one of the initiatives that's going on in the field of psychology at the moment, how to protect humanity or sustain humanity or keep in connection to our humanity in an increasingly technological age. In fact, a whole
Yeah.
chapter book on Imagination Matrix is that in China, here's the challenge. Young people in their late teens, early 20s are not connecting with other young people, particularly with people of another gender, right? In whatever way that plays out, birth rates are just crashing because people are not connecting. They're not being intimate. They're not being sexual for the most part. These are big generalizations, but it is a natural, national crisis. So much so that the government has noticed. And what they've done is that they have asked all universities and colleges in China, for the first year of study for students, one of the three or four courses needs to be on what it is to be in human relations. Okay? So there is a
Huh.
course on dating. There is a course on when you call somebody up, what you say, how you respond, what kind of date you go on, what you do afterwards, what it is to touch, how it is to touch. I mean, remarkably so. Now, we're not at that place, obviously, in the United States, and it would be silly for me to generalize, say, all of China's there. But And at the same time, it is true, and it is escalating as a national crisis.
Well, I've heard
so
that
the
there's
point
something similar
being,
going on in this country. That there is, there's a decline in sexuality. Again, I'm getting distracted by hearing an echo. Are you able to put on headphones?
I am not, but I do not hear an echo at all.
Yeah, but it could be, that could be a solution. But if you don't have any headphones, earbuds, AirPods, nothing like that.
No, I've not ever run into this.
Okay. Oh, well, I've run into it before, and now it's not happening at the moment. So I really like this concept of the curious mind, of thinking of that as a separate mind state, enough to reify it by giving it, calling it the curious mind. And one of the ways that I relate to it is aside from the fact that I've been doing these interviews forever, and people have remarked, one of the positive things that people have said is they've remarked on my curiosity. And partly where that comes from me is I did a stint for a number of years. I went into market research because I sort of felt like I topped out in academia and I was looking for new challenges. The computer revolution was happening. I wanted to get involved, and that led to me getting involved in market research. So I mostly apprenticed myself to a guy who emphasized curiosity. And that you, when you went in to talk about a product or talk with consumers, leading a research group, that you had to come at it with curiosity.
Yeah, it does open things up, and that is the way in to what I named the imagination matrix, into the autonomous imagination. You follow curiosity. And what I talk about in the book is a way of doing that. So for me personally, when I get up in the morning, first thing I'll do is listen and write down the dreams that I do remember, or fragments or images that come forward. Second thing that I do is I'll do a kind of opening curiosity exercise, a kind of active imagining exercise. And then I go to what I call in the book a dig. And when, in fact, I'm just about to do a workshop on the imagination matrix. And what I'll do is share with people the ways of accessing, finding companions, soul companions, I offer the name, and then accompanying them into imagination and really journeying. And people are journeying now in a variety of different ways in all kinds of mediums. But to allow those figures of psyche, of soul, those figures that come in dream time or in an active imagining, a waking dream, awake or a sleeping dream, and being one of the many, joining the group and going on journey and going into a place of discovery. Again, curiosity is key, right? And going into discovery and wandering about the four quadrants I name of imagination is quite extraordinary. What we learn, what we pick up, the intelligence that comes forward is really something.
You mentioned the four quadrants of the imagination, and that was a part of the book that caught me. What are the four quadrants? And particularly one of them seemed mysterious to me. So what are the four quadrants?
Oh, Earth, of course. And the I'm going to name the four quadrants, and then they interrelate, intersect, they find one another. But certainly there is the quadrant Earth, which is the regenerative capacities of the rhythms found in nature and the intelligence embedded in the natural mind, so to speak, in the natural places. Mind, and when I say mind, I I'm talking about the imaginal mind, so the soul-centered mind. I'm talking about the polytheistic mind, the many steps of the mind, of imagination, and important that quadrant, right? And the third is machine, and machine, I mean functionality. So it's everything from a early machine, hammer, saw, a bicycle, to computer now in technology and beyond. That's important now because
that was the one that struck me that I was curious about. You know, this list of things that and then machine. But yeah. we live in a world of machines. That's for sure.
We do
increasingly,
and our body is machine oriented, right? So there's a kind of functionality that's important to bring into consideration.
Uh-huh.
How things work, how we interact, how, you know, it's so important because part of what I go into is how working in imagination is so helpful in healing practices. So I've done a lot of work with integrative medicine, you know, and working with physicians and working with imagination in relation to helping to develop protocols for healing, you know, in a complementary way. And machine is very important that way, the body and how the body works and how the body interacts with imagination is really essential. So that is the third quadrant. And the fourth quadrant is that kind of overlay, the universal, right? The more transcendent quality, the cosmos itself. And when we begin to experience imagination in a matrix that essentially interrelates, interconnects, taking into account those four elemental qualities, then we are in a place that I think that really opens itself up and animates, or what I say, illuminates imagination in ways that are very, very helpful. You know, I'm a therapist, and before that, a professor, before that, a school teacher. So my interest is not in the esoteric. My interest is in how this work really comes home, you know, how this work really supports a well-being, sense of well-being and life purpose, a kind of additional sense of identity and belonging.
Yeah. Now, we haven't really talked about the structure of the book, but in some ways it's like a workbook with exercises such as you were referring to, you know, in terms of awakening the imagination mind and or the curiosity mind. And so the lazy part of me has a skeptical question that I wanted to ask you about, which is, I could imagine this being very effective in a group experience with a leader. But as a book that I'm reading, I gloss over that, you know, even though this is supposedly something that part of my job and so on, but it doesn't, I know I'm not going to do those exercises. So what, and I think that's not just me. I think there is a human tendency in that direction for some of us who are not, say, terribly introverted and you can just jump into, yes, I'm going to spend lots of time just being with myself and opening, you know. So what are you doing to address that? I heard you mentioned workshops. I assume you want to build something in to address this.
Well, there, you know, there's a community. Community is so important. The outer community of our friends, family, you know, colleagues, that community is so essential for support, for conversation, for engagement, you know. There's also an inner community, and those that inner community consists of those figures that I was naming, the soul companions, and I named them in the book, and I offer ways of making contact and, yes, an exercise, so to speak, of how to sustain a quality of contact. But when you bring those two together, when you bring people together in community, and together we are working through some of this material, it's extraordinary what begins to happen. Honestly, it's just heartfelt. So yeah, as you named, that I am doing workshops on the imagination matrix, and people can find that Under Dream Tending, the website. One's coming up in the spring. And I think that really is it. When people are having
trouble, are these in-person dreams or in-person groups or Zoom groups?
I do both. I'll do one group Zoom, and that I do a lot of that because there's a lot of folks internationally that gather. And then I do groups in person. We'll be doing three different groups on the campuses of Pacifica in this next year. So there's different ways of doing it. People really enjoy being in location, in residence, in a living community, interacting with one another. And there, of course, we're here in Santa Barbara, so we were talking about the ocean. You can actually, we take time to actually walk to the ocean and be part of that environment as well. And two, though, you know, it is remarkable when we gather online in community, what's possible when it's just not information overload. So the exercises that you alluded to, I'll offer them, and people will work with them in their home place. You know, there's a little bit of guidance there and leadership. And then they'll get connected in smaller groups of four or five in breakout rooms online, and then gather back into the bigger community and have conversation. Oh, I just finished yesterday at about 3 o'clock, a whole gathering of folks. And it's just heartfelt. It's so wonderful to be with others that have the same sensitivity, the same interest, that are bring their heart and vulnerability, and we create the safety, you know, that's required. We need safety, support, protection in order to really engage, because not all the figures that we meet in imagination are friendly, of course, right? Like in dreams, you know. In fact, what's true now is that more people than ever before are remembering dreams. The International Association of Study of Dreams just did a big research study on that. And the remembering dreams is really at an all-time high. And of course, with that comes nightmares, the nightmarish, the intolerable, the difficult, the challenging. So how do we work with those figures? You know, how do we tend to those figures in a way that is not so frightening and crippling? And we know that if we just try to push them away or psychologize them only or medicate them away, that's not the full answer. Is it helpful at times? Yes. Is it the full answer? Not really, because they tend to just come right back, you know, 3 nights later, 4 weeks later, something in awake life re-stimulates, and there's that experience that then evokes something that is problematic. In deep imagination, though, when we're journeying in imagination through a process that I offer of kind of really working with those images to find their generative quality, oh my goodness, those figures, perhaps as much as any figure, become so helpful in terms of offering guidance and opening the inquiry. You know, they really do provide incredible support and intelligence as we journey into those realms of imagination,
or
those quadrants.
Yeah, one place that comes up where I've experienced some of what you're talking about is I have a former student who took a deep dive into shamanism, and he's written a bunch of books. You may know him or be familiar with him, Alberto Violdo. And so we were looking at the possibility of me becoming one of the people in his network. And so I went to a couple of his shamanistic trainings, and it was very powerful. It was, and a lot of the power of it was just doing it with other people, making it really experiential, and using your, you know, giving yourself license to go into imagination, and not to worry about, well, is this really this or that, but just to see what comes up. And I had some powerful experiences as a result of that.
Yeah, and just what you just shared, to see who or what comes forward.
Yeah.
And not to bring the rational mind and to analyze too quickly, to interpret too quickly. No, you know, we are with our soul companions, our figures, our inner community. And there we are together, journeying in these realms and noticing who comes forward and what offerings they have, you know, what what those visitations bring to us. It is a remarkable experience, and it really has, you know, there is a sense truly of homecoming, right? There is a sense of coming home to something,
yes,
you know, really deeply felt. And then we
yeah.
in turn have a sense of belonging,
yeah.
a deep belonging.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I really, from talking to you particularly, I get the sense of the power of all of this and your own wonderful stories that you've shared with us here. And I'm sure there's so many more stories that that you can pull out. So as we start to wrap up here, amazingly, because, you know, we've not covered the whole book or anything, but who do you see as your target audience?
Oh, well, I think, you know, now the book is out and people are purchasing it and working with it, and there are workshops that are happening. There are three different groups that seem to be really coming forward. And then there's some intention that I have. The groups are certainly people that are creatives and like to explore, the people that are journeying and experiencing what it's like to touch into these, what Joseph Campbell, the outer reaches of inner space, right? And the inner reaches of outer space, you know, those folks, the journeyers, the creatives, they certainly are resonating quite deeply and beautifully. And the people that are experiencing journeying in varieties of ways, using all kinds of methods and means, they very much have resonated to this work. So it has, it's really, you know, it really pairs very well with that group of folks. Another group that is really coming forward, I know this might be startling, people in corporate America. So people that are in leadership teams, CEOs, founders of companies, because there's a valuing now. I was just the other week, I was in Los Angeles working with a very highly regarded company of young professionals. They're all in their 20s and early 30s, working, you know, nonstop with technology, doing
right.
Marketing of one sort or the next. And I was invited in by their CEO and by the founder, actually. And what was going on is, yeah, they've been successful for sure, that. And they noticed that there was a wane happening in the company with the employees, you know, starting to, burnout was happening. There was, you know, a kind of, so, you know, I was asked in to reignite or re-enliven imagination. And I offered some of the things that we're talking about and other skills and ideas. And oh my, it was so heartfelt. I can't tell you. You know, I can remember a time when I'd go into a company like that or an institution like that, and as soon as we would say anything about being a therapist, there would be, oop.
Yeah, right.
No, not that.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
Oh, just a yearning, a welcoming of imagination and being back in touch and curiosity. Oh my gosh. And these folks are so capable and bright and gifted, and they're so successful. But they knew that there was something missing now, you know, quote, the magic was missing, you know, that.
Yeah. And I've heard that some of those folks are going to psychedelic workshops to touch into those places. And of course, there's this sort of third wave boom of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. Do you have any sort of take on that? What's your sense of that?
It is very popular, for sure, that. And Pacifica has just offered a conference. It is popular. And I think the work, the tools that we're working with in this book, in the Imagination Matrix, beautiful companion to those kinds of journeying. They really, truly are. You know, with important guidance and safety, support, protection, you know, there's certain substances that do evoke imagination. And there's a lot of new experimentation going on with that. And too, without those substances, you know, and with some support and some guidance, it really is extraordinarily possible to open imagination by following the curious mind and doing some of the things that we've talked about. We're working now, you asked some of the audiences, we're working with school teachers and children to remember, child's play, to bring that back in. One of the groups that I'm working with is working with nurses to bring that back into their professional life. So there's a lot of people that are buying in and, you know, really taking the journey along these paths. Yeah.
Well, I think we probably need to wrap it up. I want to thank you. Is there anything else that you want to say that you haven't had a chance to get in here?
Well, I think one thing. There's this curious thing that happened along the way in writing the book. I noticed that another kind of intelligence was evolving. I mean, we know about intellectual intelligence, IQ, you know. We know about emotional intelligence. We now know something about artificial intelligence. We know about embodied intelligence. I mean, these are things. Something else started to happen, which I named imaginal intelligence. And it comes out of IQ4s, but we just gave it a psst, and has to do with journeying in these four quadrants in the way that we've been talking about. It increases. And when that increases, it really is measurable. I mean, we spent years doing qualitative and quantitative research, noticing how imaginal intelligence increases, and therefore creativity and well-being does the same. So it was quite something. And I think that's where really a lot of us are really wanting to work more fully and deeply to allow and offer ways of bringing that forward and bringing that into ourselves personally, into our community life, into our workspace. Yeah.
It's another question that comes to mind, which is you talked about the pull of the future. What, you know, and it's possible to go into great despair about the future, given the climate crisis and all the other the wars that are going on. What's your sense of that pull? Are you able to talk about that? Where do you feel like we're being pulled?
Well, yes, I mean, without question, just as you're naming, we don't need to go through that because we all know it, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, children know it too, because they're open, they're sensitive, they feel it. They may not have words or concepts, but they get it. Their animal body knows what it knows. Their instinctual body knows what it knows, and there's danger. It's true. So what are we going to do? I mean, you know, can't go into the third extinction. You know, we can't go in the sixth extinction. We can't keep going that way. So we need something new. And we have the capacity. I mean, it is encoded in us, the next evolution. I don't believe that we are coded to destroy ourselves or the planet. I don't think so. But I do believe, I mean, some people may go there in the dire places and talk evolutionary theory and all that kind of, but I think the bigger impulse is to move forward into well-being, creativity, frankly, bigger than anything, love. And when we open our imagination, when we really journey in imagination, you know, we meet the beloveds, we meet that sense of deep care, compassion, love, and that in turn generates the next possibilities, the pull of the future. And when we gather in small groups, I mean, I know that's conceptual, when we actually gather in small groups, when people are come forward from the workshop, we go around and listen as people share what's happened to them as a result of taking these journeys. Oh my goodness, they are feeling a renewed sense of purpose, of care, of community, of participation. Their heart is warmed and opened, you know. And again, there's no need for me to romanticize or idealize. I just been doing this for too many years, not helpful. The actuality is, though, to be in community and to be in imagination, to open curiosity, really does open the next possibilities. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's a beautiful close. And so, Dr. Steve Eisenstadt, it's great to talk to you again, experience you again, and keep up your very important pioneering work. Wow, what an inspiring chat I had with today's guest. Of course, I'm referring to return guest Steve Eisenstadt, PhD, whom I interviewed 10 years ago about his book on dream tending. He's not only a well-known Jungian author, educator, and dream worker, but notably the founder of the Pacifica Graduate Institute, which is the place for earning college-accredited degrees in Jungian psychology and psychotherapy. As you may already be well aware, many of my previous guests have been either faculty or graduates of that wonderful school. In the interview, it occurred to me out of the blue to ask how the school got its name. Turns out it was a long and tortured process with many name changes along the way. They even hired an advertising agency to generate a list of possible names, but none of those names made the grade. Of course, the name emerged for Steve from his intuitive mind, and it immediately felt right to everyone. The purpose of our interview today was to discuss Steve's latest book, The Imagination Matrix, How to Access the Greatest Power You Have for Creativity, Connection, and Purpose. Now, that title might sound a little grandiose, but it's based on Steve's 40-plus years of Jungian study and personal friendships with such Jungian greats as James Hillman, Marion Woodman, Joseph Campbell, among others. The book presents an integrated model for a cognitive understanding of the unconscious and how to access it. It's also a workbook with exercises. I opined that I think it would work best as part of a group process. Indeed, Steve confirmed the power of combining self-study with group sharing, both during in-person workshops at the Pacifica campus and in online Zoom presentations and breakout groups. You'll find details and schedules at the dreamtending.com website. I salute Dr. Eisenstadt as a pioneer and visionary. The power and effectiveness of his work is already well documented. Be sure to listen to the segment in our interview in which he describes his work with the United Nations and UNESCO. I feel privileged to know him and to bring this life-changing work to you.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Tim here. I'm a psychologist from the Gold Coast, Australia. I was thinking recently it was about time I got off my butt and contributed some money to your wonderful program. It's given me so many hours of pleasure and education, especially on the drives to work. And I think it's important to support your mighty efforts, Dr. Dave. So I'd urge everyone out there to donate, contribute some money to make sure your show, very fine show, Shrink Wrap Radio, is around for a very long time. Okay, see you later.
Thank you, Tim, psychologist there on the Gold Coast of Australia. Tim, I'm doing everything I can to keep the show going, and I appreciate your feedback. Thank you for your donation and for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Thanks to my guest, Steven Eisenstadt, PhD, Jungian educator and dream worker, discussing his new book, The Imagination Matrix, How to Access the Greatest Power You Have for Creativity, Connection, and Purpose. I'm so impressed by his visionary and pioneering work. Our next guest will be Professor Amy Harbin on the ethical importance of fearing well. You heard that right, fearing, F-E-A-R-I-N-G, fearing well. You won't want to miss this one. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.